and it grabs you.
Reflections with Peter Hennessy, tomorrow at 9 o'clock in the morning and again in the evening at 9:30.
If you tune into Radio 4 on 198 Longwave now, you can hear the daily service led this morning by the Reverend Ernie Ray. Here on Radio 4 FM, Nancy Crane continues to read from Diane Hales' new book, Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered.
In my search for the real Mona Lisa, I discovered that her ancestors, the Gherardini, blazed out of the mists of myth and history. In a time before time, the Trojan prince Aeneas, son of the goddess Venus, fled his besieged city with his father on his back and his young son by his side. His band of loyal followers wandered for years before arriving in the kingdom of Latium on the Italian peninsula. After marrying its monarch's daughter and ascending to the throne, Aeneas divided the kingdom among his descendants. Etruria, the land we know as Tuscany, went to his son Gherardo, who passed it on to his sons, and the sons of his sons, the little Gherardos, or Gherardini, so the legend goes. Is it true? Historians have long accused Italy's chroniclers of creating a golden legend to enhance the glories of their past and embellish the achievements of the present. If they were great enough to create these myths, the German poet Goethe observed, we should be great enough to believe them. The romantic in me wants to believe. The journalist craves something more. This much is certain. In Italy, lineage matters. Ancestry tells Italians not only where a person came from, but also the type of character the generations have forged. In search of Lisa Gherardini's forebears, I head to the Florence State Archive, a bleak, utterly unromantic bunker that squats in busy Piazza Beccaria near the Market of Sant'Ambrogio. Within its concrete walls lies the patrimony of Tuscany, a staggering 46 miles of decrees, manuscripts, registries, charters, drawings, maps, tax records, and other artifacts dating back to the 700s. In addition, the archive houses letters, diaries, and hundreds of ricordi, the family record books of a populace of obsessive takers of notes and makers of lists. Powerful personalities emerge from the sea of information. Men who wish to show their superiority over other animals, reads the inscription in one book, should make every effort not to pass through this life silently, as do sheep. The Gherardini, I quickly discover, were no sheep. I begin my quest by exchanging my passport for the oldest book I have ever touched, a history of the Gherardini written by a family member, Don Niccolo Gherardini, in 1586. As I turn the brittle pages, the ink, blotched in places, still sparkles in the light. I begin to make out a few familiar Italian words. Soon I am caught up in a sweeping saga of dastardly deeds and deadly vendettas. One Gherardini, I read, betrayed by a co-conspirator in a daring plot to overthrow the government of Florence, is imprisoned, tortured, convicted, and sentenced to death. The entry ends with the chilling word, decapitato. Beheaded, I ask my historian guide. She shrugs. The bloody history of the Gherardini strikes her as fairly typical in a city with violence encoded into its civic DNA. The Gherardini, among the most ancient, wealthy, and bellicose of feudal warlords, were fighters. Their gold-spurred knights, or cavalieri, seized possession of a vast swathe of the Chianti countryside in medieval times and lorded over hamlets, parishes, vineyards, olive groves, and forests. Gherardini brothers wielded their swords in the service of Britain's King Henry II in his conquest of the island of Hibernia, now Ireland. Richly rewarded, some settled there and established the dynasties of the Geraldines and the Fitzgeralds, meaning son of Gerald, which claim President John Fitzgerald Kennedy as their most illustrious son. But Tuscany in the Middle Ages was no Camelot, and its cavalieri were no gallant Galahads. Scarcely able to write their own names, as deeds signed with an X attest, the Gherardini charge across the pages of even the driest of historical tomes, like savage brigands. Sweeping down from their fortress castles, they warred against rivals, ransacked the countryside, and plundered abbeys and convents. If merchants on the market road between Siena and Florence refused to pay hefty tolls, they would slash the heel tendons of their donkeys and confiscate all the merchandise they carried. This outraged the Comune of Florence, run by guilds of tradesmen determined to safeguard their supply routes. In 1135, troops marched into Chianti to wrangle the robber barons into submission. Raising castles and torching fields, they forced the gentry, including the Gherardini, to move to Florence. And thus, the 14th century historian Giovanni Villani reports, the Comune of Florence began to expand, either by force or by argument, increasing its territory and bringing under its jurisdiction all the country nobility. But citified did not mean civilized. Forced out of their mountain lairs, the magnati, or magnates as they were designated, still lusting for dominion, marked their new territory by building armed towers linked by spindly bridges to the houses of allied families. Florence sprouted a forest of 150 such towers, some higher than 200 feet, all hated symbols of the arrogance and insolence of these glorified gang leaders. Although the incorrigible street fighters didn't sheathe their swords, the Florentine magnates took up the mantle of church protectors and civic leaders. In addition to swashbuckling warriors, the Gherardini family history records upstanding vicars, governors, ambassadors, and patrons of churches and charities. Their men regularly ascended to the highest political posts as priors and gonfalonieri, members of the Signoria, Florence's governing body, which presided over ever-increasing prosperity in the city. Yet prosperity didn't bring peace. The people united to bring down the nobles, ordering the magnates' fortress towers to be reduced to a maximum height of 100 feet. In a deafening citywide demolition, parapets and bricks cascaded into the streets. The stones were used to construct a new set of protective city walls extending south across the Arno. Symbolically, the mighty also were falling. But the Gherardini's unyielding spirit not only endured, it became the stuff of local legends, such as the story of the valiant military captain Cecce de Gherardini. He spoke out in the Signoria against war with Siena not once but three times despite threats of execution. He was overruled and dutifully led his men south into battle. But two friars who had secretly agreed to open Siena's gates to the army double-crossed the Florentines, and as the great doors creaked open, the Senesi roared forward. Some 2,500 Florentines, including Cecce de Gherardini, died. No family was spared, and in the aftermath, the Gherardini and their vanquished fellows were banished from Florence and headed to Lucca to bide their time until the political pendulum swung back in their favor some 30 years later. In 1302, crisis hit Florence like a tsunami, shattering the lives of the Gherardini and also of Italy's greatest poet and my literary hero, Dante Alighieri. When he was serving a two-month term as a prior in the Signoria, civil war erupted. The so-called Blacks and the Whites, two feuding factions, raged through Florence. Dante, one of the Whites, escaped the bloodbath, but the victorious Blacks sentenced him and 350 others to lifetime exile. These refugees would face immediate execution if they were to return. Dante never came back to his hometown and would compose his literary masterwork, The Divine Comedy, while wandering, like a boat without a sail or rudder, for two decades around the Italian peninsula. The exiled Gherardini retreated to their rural estates, but they couldn't escape the wrath of their enemies. Naldo Gherardini, a clan leader with a reputation as an aggressive hothead, barricaded himself and his family into their castle at Montaghiari in Chianti. The Blacks pursued them and ultimately razed the stronghold to the ground. Some of the defeated Gherardini migrated to Verona and Venice. Others stayed in Chianti. One branch of the family was granted permission to build a new villa a few miles away on the Greve River, with the stipulation that it never be fortified. They named this unarmed oasis Vigna Maggio, or May Vineyard. Part of Vigna Maggio's lore is the fanciful notion that Lisa Gherardini was born there, although a land deed confirms its sale almost 60 years before her birth. Now a cozy inn, my husband and I visit and eat lunch with the genial owner. Just across the river, we can make out the castle ruins and family chapel, rebuilt in the 17th century and still decorated with the Gherardini coat of arms. As we linger on a sun-dappled terrace, I imagine Lisa's ancestors in this same spot, gazing across the valley at the silent testimony to all that they had lost. As the magnate's power and prestige ebbed, some had to sell off lands to pay creditors, and more than a few descended into the ranks of what one historian calls the shame-faced poor. The Gherardini were die-hard aristocrats, clinging to the trappings of past glory, comforting themselves with pride in never falling so low that they had to pursue a base occupation or trade, and never marrying beneath them. These consolations wore thin as they plunged into bitter family infighting. As I labored through a scholarly history of Florentine magnates in Italian, a single sentence stopped me in mid-page. I Gherardini si odiavano di cuore. The Gherardini hated each other with all their hearts. The sparring family had elevated what we now call dysfunction to a level worthy of historical record. Eventually, in the late 14th century, they united, but only to join a plot to overthrow the Florence Comune's leaders. The conspirators were foiled by the rising de' Medici family, and most of them were sentenced to death. The owner of the family villa at Vigna Maggio, Felice Gherardini, was punished with exile, wandering through Europe for over 20 years until he was finally pardoned. Years later, his granddaughter, Margherita, would return to Tuscany to marry Francesco Dattini, the entrepreneurial tycoon famed in Italian history as the Merchant of Prato. Little Beta, as the family called her, should have then faded into obscurity. Instead, we know more about her than any other woman of her time, thanks to her husband's compulsive preservation of almost every piece of paper that crossed his hands, including the letters exchanged with his rebellious and singularly outspoken young wife, as the historian Barbara Tuchman describes her. "I can feel the Gherardini in my blood," Margherita declares in one of her notes. I come to know this Tuscan Donna Vera through her writing. She was vivacious, intelligent, practical, energetic, devout, and iron-willed. Her words reveal both what it was like to be a woman and a wife in 15th century Tuscany, and how it felt to have the Gherardini fires of the heart, or their Gherardiname, a particular Gherardininess, as family members dubbed it, raging within her. Learning more about her led me to a fuller understanding of her kinswoman, the Mona Lisa. Traveling to Prato to discover more, I began to see Francesco and Margherita as a couple, perhaps not unlike Lisa and her own Francesco del Giocondo, and not unlike some contemporary spouses as well. Ambitious, avaricious, and opportunistic, as was Lisa's husband, the Merchant of Prato wheeled and dealed and strained laws and commandments to breaking point and beyond. The workaholic merchant lived in a state of angst he called melancholia, or constant anxiety. I can imagine the stressed-out businessman as a character in a Woody Allen film, perhaps a neurotic, death-obsessed Wall Street trader with a therapist on speed dial, flinging his cell phone across the room when it drops a call. Sapiti temperare. Learn to temper yourself, Margherita would enjoin her choleric spouse. No stereotypically meek helpmate, she evolved from a quick-tempered girl into a confident woman, berating her husband when he behaved badly, which was often. When the Gherardiname rose in her, which it sometimes did a dozen times a day, as she confessed in one letter, Margherita pulled no punches. Friends may have cautioned Dattini about her before marriage, but nothing deterred him. He looked beyond the bottom line of this fiery, self-willed, and impoverished girl to her other assets: youth, good looks, and aristocratic blood. Lisa Gherardini would offer her equally venal suitor, Francesco del Giocondo, similar gifts, and very little else.
Nancy Crane was reading from Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered by Diane Hales. The book was abridged by Eileen Horn and produced by Clive Brill. It's a Brill production for BBC Radio 4. The news is coming up, but first, here's James Naughtie.
We hear a great deal from politicians and commentators involved on both sides of the debate on Scottish independence. Now, at last, it's time for those who really matter in the referendum argument to have their voices heard. The people who will cast their ballots on September the 18th, and in doing so, will define the future of Scotland and the whole of the United Kingdom. Join me, James Naughtie, and an invited Edinburgh Festival audience for The Voter's Voice, tomorrow evening at 8 on BBC Radio 4.